Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. A quorum is present. Thank you, everybody, for coming early this morning. We don't usually meet at 8:30, and I know it's a little bit of a thing to do that, and other people have to be in a lot of different places as well. So I don't think we have any minutes this morning, so we will proceed to our agenda. And the first bill on the agenda is House Bill 4412, Representative Greenman, who is here. And I will move that House Bill 4412 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Greenman, welcome. Go ahead and present House Bill 4412.
Good morning, and this is my first time, I think, in Health Committee, so it's nice to be with you this morning. This is House Bill 4412 is a technical bill that gives the authority for the Department of Veterans Affairs to operate pharmacies at, or central pharmacy, I should say, which is actually already operating. It's a technical bill because the OLA suggested that we put it in statute, but it's already happening, and so this just makes sure that we get that solid.
Very good. And I don't think there are any testifiers listed, but is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anybody. Is there any member discussion? Not seeing any. So, well, thank you. So this, I understand there's no cost to the bill. As you said, it's a technical clarification, and of course it's here because of pharmacy and so on, which is in our jurisdiction. So, all right, so there being no discussion, I will renew my motion that House Bill 4412 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. It is on its way. Okay, next on the agenda is what might be considered the main event for the morning, I suppose, is the House Bill 4247, which is House Bill 4247, which is the minibus scope and licensing bill. And today, all we're going to do with the bill is have a walkthrough. And we're going to take testimony on the bill, and then we're going to have markup tomorrow. So we're not doing any amendments today, although amendments to the bill have been posted. So in your packets, you have the bill. You have the spreadsheet for the bill. This is all special revenue funds. And so we are not going to actually move the bill this morning, I guess. Or should we move the bill? Okay, maybe I think I kind of need to move it to bring it before the committee. So I'm going to move House File 4247 to bring it before the committee, and the motion will be to send it to Ways and Means. So when we vote this out tomorrow, it'll go to Ways and Means. So with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Sunderman to give us a high-level. Oh, well, let me first actually move the DE. So that's a good reason to have moved the bill in the first place. Okay, so we should adopt the DE so that we can then walk through it. So then I'm going to move the DE3 amendment to House Bill 4247, which is the omnibus, the minibus bill, I should say. So all in favor of adoption of DE3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE3 is adopted. Okay, now that we got all that out of the way, I think we can go to Ms. Sunderman to do a walkthrough of the bill.
All right, Madam Chair and members, as Chair Liebling said, I'll be doing a high-level walkthrough of the DE3 amendment. So Article 1 provides for registration of transfer care specialists by the Commissioner of Health, and authorizes transfer care specialists who are registered with the commissioner to remove and transport dead human bodies from the place of death to a licensed funeral establishment. And this was from House File 2509, the first engrossment. Moving to Article 2, this was from House File 3741 as amended in committee. This article establishes behavior analyst licensure to practice applied behavior analysis. It establishes the behavior analyst advisory council, specifies fees, and appropriates money later on in Article 9 for the implementation. Moving to Article 3, the Board of Veterinary Medicine. This article establishes licensure for veterinary technicians from House File 1228 and makes related changes. And then it also modifies institutional or faculty licensure at the University of Minnesota. That was from House File 1817 as amended, and that's for any person who is not eligible for a regular veterinary license seeking to practice veterinary medicine while employed at the University of Minnesota. Article 4 is the Board of Dentistry. This article allows specialty dentists who hold general dental licenses to practice general dentistry outside of their designated specialty area. That is from House File 3612. And it also modifies a requirement for dental assistant licensure by credential from House File 2111. That's just changing an and to an or. Article 5, Physician Assistant Practice. This is a repealer. This is House File 3494. It repeals Section 147A.09, Subdivision 5, which contains collaborative practice agreement requirements for physician assistants to provide ongoing psychiatric treatment. Under current law, a physician assistant has to have an additional practice agreement with the licensed physician in order to provide ongoing psychiatric treatment. And it specifies what that additional agreement must include. Article 6 is the Board of Social Work. This is from House File 3626 as amended in committee. This article reorganizes and modifies sections of statute governing the Board of Social Work provisional licensure, modifies requirements related to provisional licensure eligibility, disciplinary action, and supervision. And it also includes a revisor instruction to renumber the listed social work provisional license sections of statute into Chapter 148E with the rest of the social work statute. Article 7, the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. This article was from the original House File 4247. It establishes guest licensure for the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy for eligible non-residents who wish to practice temporarily in Minnesota without being licensed, and it also establishes fees. Article 8, this is the Board of Pharmacy article. This article adds Board of Pharmacy application and fee requirements for relocation and change of ownership of licensed entities and specifies that licenses and registrations are not transferable. These provisions are from House File 4099. The article also modifies opiate manufacturer, wholesaler, and third-party logistics provider reporting requirements, and this is from House File 4098. And finally, Article 9 is the appropriations article, and it includes appropriations from the State Government Special Revenue Fund to the Commissioner of Health, Board of Psychology, Board of Veterinary Medicine, Board of Dentistry, Board of Social Work, Board of Marriage and Family Therapy to implement the provisions in the rest of the bill. And that is the bill.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Sunderman. So a little smaller than what we usually do in this committee, right? And I guess I would just add that there's really nothing in here that didn't come through committee, and the amendments are all amendments that were done here in committee. So some of the blanks got filled in from some of the blank appropriations got filled in from fiscal notes and so on. So we have some testifiers who have signed up, and so we can take testimony on the bill. And so I have on the list Sue Abderholen. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and give your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Member Sue Abderholen, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And we have serious concerns with the bill as written. We fully understand the dire need to increase access to mental health care and to build our workforce, but we must take great care not to compromise on the quality of care. While PAs typically complete around 2,000 hours of postgraduate patient care, they only take 1 2-semester credit course in psychiatry and a 4 to 6 week rotation in psychiatry. This is very different than APRNs, who are required to choose one of 4 roles and then choose one population focus, one of which is psychiatric and mental health care. APRNs who don't specialize in psychiatry are directed not to treat people with serious mental illnesses. The U of M Psych APRN program is a doctoral level program, and most of the 81 academic credits are on mental health, and 960 of their 1,000 hours are psychiatric specific patient care. Other mental health professionals, such as social workers, are required to have 4,000 hours. One class and one rotation does not qualify you to diagnose and treat people with serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and other diagnoses that involve psychosis. Schizophrenia is one of the most disabling conditions in the world. PAs are simply not qualified to diagnose or develop a treatment plan for this serious illness or others. We have not found a hospital provider who is confused by the current statute, and you can easily clarify what serious mental illnesses are by listing them. A 2013 legislative report found that PAs are underqualified to serve people with serious mental illnesses. Our state is not more restrictive than other states. In fact, the National PA organization found only 3 states are rated less restrictive than Minnesota, and they found over 20 states being rated more restrictive. It's been said to our members that PAs are clear in their scope of practice and would refer people with these illnesses on to psychiatrists, but then why change the law? There is no reason to repeal this section of the statute. We are open to allowing PAs to specialize, provided they have additional training and take their national tests in psychiatry as recommended by their national organization. We are open to clarifying the law. We are not open to repealing the law. Before you vote, I ask that you pause and remember that the very people that PAs want to treat don't want this law repealed. The people who are actually trained to diagnose and treat people with serious mental illnesses, psychiatrists, psychologists, other mental health professionals, don't want this law repealed. Thank you.
Thank you. Next I have, let's see, where's my list? Oh, there we go. I have Tom Wayman. Oh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's an interesting day. I think I'm the only person here in support of your bill.
That's really sad.
It is. And I appreciate being here. Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Lehman. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. Appreciate this opportunity to comment on the DE amendment. Unlike the previous testifier, I'll be speaking in support of the bill and in support of patients who need mental health services. We want to thank you, Chair Liebling, for Article 5 in the bill, which includes the provisions of Representative Bonner's bill to expand access to mental health services. As you heard in testimony on her bill and continue to hear from advocates, from hospitals, from clinics, from law enforcement agencies, from schools and families, the demand for mental health services is increasing. At the same time, we're experiencing severe shortages of clinicians who can diagnose mental illness, prescribe medications, and monitor the reactions to those medications. We heard statements that the mental health system is in crisis because of this shortage. The previous testifier said this multiple times this session. Yesterday, in Representative Fisher's committee, she submitted written testimony that, quote, everyone at NAMI Minnesota has heard from parents and children with mental illnesses trying desperately to get their child, the services they need. She's correct. We need more mental health providers of all types and of all licensures. Article 5 helps address the shortage of mental health clinicians. I remind you that the Board of Medical Practice strongly supports this provision because the concerns raised by the opponents have no merit. Madam Chair, budget realities mean you'll not be given a budget target this year that will allow you to make needed investments in our healthcare system, including mental health. But Article 5 of your bill will make a meaningful difference for patients who are waiting to get the mental health care they need and the hospitals where these patients are now being warehoused in emergency departments. Thank you, Madam Chair, for including this important provision in your bill, and I encourage members of the committee to continue to support it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lehman. And I'm sure there are other people here who are supporting the bill. They're just not coming up to testify.
Really? I think he's the only one. No.
So. Okay. So we can take some questions, I guess. I mean, if there are specific questions of the testifiers, I think we could do that. Otherwise, we're not really. I guess this is the time if we're going to do that. Representative Bierman?
Yeah, I wondered if Ms. Abderholden could come back down.
And also, just since we're talking about language that is being repealed in the bill, I don't know, Ms. Sunderman, is the language actually here someplace so that we could be looking at it?
Madam Chair, members, no, it isn't. When it's posted, I believe when the first engrossment is posted on the revisor's website, the repealer language will be there.
Okay. All right. So, members, if you want to look at the language, which I think might be important here, it's section 147A.09, subdivision 5, if you're pulling it up on your computers. It's a short paragraph.
Can you say that one more time?
One more time, please.
Yeah, it's in the bill. The repealer is section 147A.09, subdivision 5.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted, Ms. Abderholden, I just wanted to ask a question on the, Mr. Lehman made the comment about the need for mental health treatment, and obviously that's known by all of us, and there's just a very wide continuum of care in mental health, and I think what we're talking about are the extreme cases of psychiatric care that are further beyond perhaps the training of the PAs, in your opinion. And I just am wanting to understand that the current practice contains collaborative care practice, which would be a PA, maybe a psychiatric medical doctor, and an administrator to help coordinate that. So I'm just wondering, with this change in law, whether the PA becomes strictly in charge of this patient and it's not collaborative care anymore, or if they would seek out further treatment with a professional who has that more advanced practice that you described. And I just want your understanding of that.
Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bierman, in one of the kind of online forms for a practice agreement, antipsychotics were not even listed as something you would check off to be able to even prescribe. And I just truly worry, because when we've heard the testimony from PAs, it's like, we're able to do this. And I think there has to be some knowledge of, what you don't know. And diagnosing schizophrenia is actually very difficult, as is bipolar disorder. If you prescribe the wrong medication for bipolar disorder, thinking it's depression, you can send someone into mania. There's just a lot there. And frankly, we just don't want to risk that. These are complicated mental illnesses, and they should only be diagnosed in the initial treatment plan. Remember, under the current statute, you can do ongoing. So once someone is stabilized with schizophrenia, yes, use the PAs to make sure they continue with their medication and can get prescriptions. But that initial diagnosis and that initial treatment plan, which often takes many different medications before you find the right one, should not be done by a PA, even with consultation.
Thank you. Thank you, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification and your understanding. And I do think that it's really important that everybody in the medical field nowadays is practicing up to their scope and making sure that we're utilizing the abilities of all professionals at all levels. And you commented on the APRNs may be better qualified in this capacity. And so I'm just trying to make sure that if there's a need for a higher professionalism, that it's still there in the bill. And just to understand that how important that is, practicing up to your scope, and if if PAs can do mental health treatment to a certain level, we want to keep that happening. So appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Oh, well, we have a couple other questions on the list here.
I would like to hear a response.
Okay. Zachary Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative Bierman, on the National PA website, they talk about how PAs can specialize in mental health care, taking, for example, a year-long training program like we have at Regents Hospital, taking the national test. If they did that, we would be more comfortable with them actually specializing in psychiatry.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nadal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Everett Holden. So prohibiting subdivision 5, eliminating subdivision 5 as a prohibition of service, does it make you feel any better with subdivision 3 in that statute remaining in place that requires a PA to have that practice agreement at the practice level that describes the practice and having that relationship with the doctor? That's remaining in statute. So that doesn't make you, can you talk about why that doesn't make you feel any better?
Ms. Afterholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Doe, it doesn't make me feel any better because I just don't think that's the scope of practice that they should be engaged in, even if they're working, you know, with a physician. You know, again, PAs can actually have their own practice. They don't have to have a doctor on site. And when we're talking about serious mental illnesses, that really does make me nervous. You know, these are the people that I hear from every day. At NAMI, nearly 100% of our board staff volunteers either live with a mental illness, have a family member, and they were all like, no, we don't think they have the experience or the training to do this. And sometimes you don't actually know, you know, when you call and make an appointment that it's a PA. And so I think, you know, it's just really important that that if you're going to diagnose and treat, that you have more than one class and more than one 4 to 6 week rotation.
Representative Nadal.
And just one follow-up. And I mean, and I'm reading this, and it says the physician assistant shall have a practice agreement. So they can have their own clinic. I get all this, but they shall have a practice agreement. So they can't practice without an agreement. Is that not true?
Yeah, and I'll respond to that. You know, yeah, that is absolutely the case, Representative Nadal.
Thank you.
Yeah. New Brindley. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And clearly we're all thinking along the same lines. And so thank you for being here, Ms. Abdur Holden. So my question is, they have a practice agreement in place. However, even with the practice agreement in place, they're able to have their own freestanding practice without a physician physically on the premises? So they don't have direct supervision or necessarily direct consultation with a physician?
Yeah, and you know, I think maybe we should get Mr. Lehman down here because he represents the PAs. I don't know if Ms. Abdur Holden is sort of the expert on all things PA. If you're asking kind of a general question, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to hear from the perspective from both of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a matter of, or maybe even Ms. Sunderman. I mean, because it's kind of, you're asking a question about what does the law allow.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Ms. Afterholden, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, on their website, they have a Q&A, and it says on there, can you open up your own practice and not have a physician there? You still have to have the collaborative agreement. And it says yes, and it tells them how to do it. So I assume that then that's what they can do.
Representative Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Mr. Lehman wants to contradict that at all. Or
well,
Mr. Lehman.
Again, Tom Lehman on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Physician Assistants. Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, PAs do not have independent practice. PAs cannot open their own clinic. PAs cannot start a mental health center and run it themselves. PAs must have a collaborative agreement with a licensed physician. The PAs that practice in Minnesota all have that. Some practice, whether it's in psychiatry, orthopedics, neurology, a host of specialties, They, depending on the clinic or the practice site, a physician may be there, may not be there. This initially was brought to us, this issue was brought to us by Hennepin Health, who had a PA in charge of a mental health clinic in South Minneapolis and had the practice agreement with the psychiatrist, but their lawyers, well, apparently, I don't know if it's their lawyers, but Hennepin Health determined that they weren't comfortable having a PA running a clinic, even though they're licensed to provide these services by the Board of Medical Practice. And so they were looking at shutting down this clinic and removing access to mental health services in this area of South Minneapolis. They subsequently found a workaround, and the PA was able to continue running that clinic. The comment I have that we have in response to that is, if a law requires a workaround to allow licensed clinicians to provide desperately needed care, that suggests that the law may be, there may be some issues with that law.
All right. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you said that they are currently licensed to provide these services. So presumably, in that clinical setting, they were exclusively providing the ongoing psychiatric treatment and not the initial diagnosis and care plan?
No.
Mr. Lehman.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Brittany. PAs are licensed to diagnose, prescribe medications, and monitor ongoing compliance or ongoing reactions to that medication. A patient may enter a clinic, and this happens every day, all across the state, and they see a PA. PAs provide over 10 million patient visits a year. This is, you know, there's a lot of PAs and they're providing good care across the state. But a patient can enter a clinic, mental health clinic, or a general practice clinic, and the PA can diagnose that this person has a mental illness. That happens daily. The majority, actually, of mental health diagnoses are done in the family practice setting, and the majority of medications dealing with mental illness are not prescribed by psychiatrists, they're prescribed by family practice and other, you know, internal medicine and other folks. Now, in the case of a patient that is severely mentally ill, Sue Abderhilden referenced this, it's up to the PA in consultation with their the practice agreement that they have with their physician to determine, is this something I can handle or is this something I need to refer on? Just to remind folks, this happens every day across healthcare, whether you're a PA, an APRN, a physician. A patient may present and that clinician may say, this is beyond my abilities and I need to refer to a specialist or a subspecialist. But in answer to your question, a PA can diagnose the initial mental illness, can prescribe medications, and can monitor that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. You know, I expressed concern with this initially, and I continue to have concern with this because I do believe that we're trying to equate a PA with psychiatric training that they don't necessarily have. And we were getting to this point in the initial hearing as well. And while my concern is that while we are suggesting that they can and should seek collaboration with psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, it will no longer be required under the law. And that is concerning to me, that this removes that protection that they're able to provide that ongoing psychiatric care. But now, even without the advanced education and training, they are allowed to provide the initial diagnosis and treatment plan. I do think that that's concerning. And I also have a real concern. I am so aware of the mental health crisis that we have. But I become very concerned when our solution to that is to decrease the training and the education requirements of providers. And to be clear, I'm a huge fan of PAs. That's actually my choice. I usually choose either a PA or an APRN for my own healthcare. Because I just like seeing them better. I like the care I receive from them. But it does feel like in this instance that perhaps we are eliminating some really important requirements that would currently exist. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brindley. And I'd like to just make a comment as well. So, you know, the issue expressed here, the issue between, you know, access and competency is one that we face all across these licensing and scope bills. That's kind of our, you know, the quintessential problem that we face. How do we balance these? I'd like everyone to look carefully at what is being repealed here. The word diagnosis does not appear. I've been really wondering where everybody's getting this from, because PAs right now can diagnose, and if this is repealed, they will still be able to diagnose. This does not stop any diagnosis right now being in the law. I think Representative Nadeau was really putting his finger on it. We have to, you know, whatever issues there might be, however much we might like to see more guardrails around this or that, what we're doing here doesn't touch any of that. This just operates as an additional, to me, it's almost like a redundancy. It's just putting a saying again, and we really mean it, when it with regard to psychiatric issues. There's nowhere here that it says a PA may not diagnose. A PA may diagnose, as Mr. Lehman was saying. So while I appreciate members' concerns, and my understanding of how PAs operate is that, you know, just like physicians, whose scope is really not laid out in statute. I mean, I like to use my husband. I probably did in the regular, in the hearing on the bill. My husband is an internist, trained internist. He does not do surgery. His license says he could do surgery. He doesn't do surgery because he knows that's not his scope. He's not trained to do surgery. This happens all across physician practice. And PAs who function or are under the Board of Medical Practice, who are medically trained like physicians and who operate with collaborative agreement always, have the same kind of thing. It isn't spelled out in their practice statute. Now, we could argue it should be. We could argue that maybe we don't like what their scope is or we want it, but this bill isn't doing that. This bill's just removing a redundancy that really isn't doing anything. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps we can get clarification from nonpartisan staff, because while you're right that it doesn't state in the negative that they cannot diagnose, it does state in the affirmative that they may only provide ongoing psychiatric care, which implies the negative, that then they can't do the initial care and treatment plan. So while it doesn't give the negative, in the affirmative, it says they are only allowed to do this. And it uses the word only. So I'm wondering if we can get clarification.
Sunderman?
Madam Chair, members, I think it's important to look at subdivision one of this section as well. This is the it's physician assistants shall practice medicine only under an established practice agreement, and the scope of practice includes services within the training and experience of the physician assistant. So this has to be in place regardless. Subdivision 5 is essentially an additional collaborative practice agreement that if a PA wants to provide ongoing psychiatric care to children with emotional disturbance and or adults with serious mental illness, they have to have this extra collaborative practice agreement. And this section or this subdivision is more specific as to what that must include. But repealing this does not get rid of the initial practice agreement requirement that requires the PA to practice within their training and experience, if that makes sense.
And I would just say, Representative Brindley, I think that kind of proves your point that this is confusing.
Well, and can I ask one more clarification? Thank you, Madam Chair, because actually that was helpful. So Ms. Sunderland, are you suggesting then that because of Subdivision 1, the requirement would actually be in place that physician assistant would have the additional psychiatric training to be able to practice at that level?
Ms. Sunderland?
Madam Chair, members, I would say that currently the practice agreement requires the PA to only provide services within their training and experience. I don't know how it is working out in the real world, what a practice agreement might include, if it's broad, if it's very specific. So I can't really speak to the individual practice agreements, but under the statute, it should only be services within the training and experience of the physician assistant.
Madam Chair.
Representative Brindley.
That might include ongoing psychiatric care, but not necessarily.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Actually, that is really interesting to me, because perhaps that would give, hopefully, everyone maybe some comfort with this language, removing Subdivision 5, but clarifying that as part of the agreement, that PAs would need the additional training and education to be able to practice at that level, so that we know that if those PAs are functioning at that level, that they would have that additional education and training. That might be the answer to ensuring it's likely already the case, it sounds like, but to ensure that it's happening in practice. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Brindley. And I think, you know, as I said, across many different areas of health licensees, we see the same kind of issue. It's very hard to spell out everything that's within the scope and outside the scope. And as has been pointed out, the APRNs don't even have a practice agreement. They got rid of their collaborative agreement. They themselves decide what their scope is without a physician at all. So, you know, it's kind of something that could be looked at across all of our practice acts. But it's not what's before us today is the issue that, in my view, and the reason I included this in the bill, is that taking out this section only resolves confusion. It doesn't increase anybody's scope. And so, you know, it's not because they have to be under a practice agreement. And, you know, if you want to work, I think, for next year, you know, go ahead and work on better definitions across the board. But I have to say, PAs also practice in other areas, just like APRNs do. I mean, it's not just mental illness. You know, I mean, it's across lots of very important areas where, just like physicians, you know, what they do matters a great deal to people's health. So, you know, we could say the same thing about, I'm struggling to pull up some area of medical practice. But, you know, they follow people and, you know, do work in lots of critical areas, not just this one. Yes. So, yeah, Mr. Lehman?
Well, just two comments, and I know this is taking more time than you probably expected. One is, Madam Chair and Representative Brindley, Subdivision 5, you also look at the word ongoing. That is not defined. So, again, clinicians and hospitals are saying, if a patient presents in the ER and a PA sees them, does that mean they're barred from seeing them when they're admitted upstairs? If a PA sees a patient in a hospital psych unit, are they barred from seeing that patient once they're discharged? You know, what is ongoing? No one knows. The other thing I'll just repeat again. The Board of Medical Practice, who's charged with protecting the public health and safety, supports this provision, supports this bill. And as they say, they voted at its January 13th meeting in support of this. If the concerns that are being raised about PA's quality or education or practice were real and valid, here's who would be issuing sanctions here's would be investigating those complaints. Here are the people who would be taking action to protect the public health from these things that are are happening. The reality is they aren't happening. There aren't complaints being filed with the Board of Medical Practice. Patients are not being harmed. PAs are not sort of willy-nilly going out and just doing stuff. That violates their training. It violates their license to practice. And it violates their sort of ethical code to do what they can do, but when they can't, just like an APRN, just like perhaps an internist may have to refer at times. Patients may come to an internist and they may say, this is beyond my capacity. Clinicians have to refer on to someone, and that's what PAs do. They practice within their scope and within the guidelines. And again, and the final comment I'll make is, PAs evolve in their education. A PA may start out of school and have a very limited scope agreement with their physician. As they get more experience, that scope may expand as their physician sees that they're better. An anecdote, Dr. Trangle, who used to run the psych unit at Regents years ago when we were having earlier conversations about PAs, said in a public meeting that Tracy Kaiser, who helped run the unit with him, who was a PA, was a better clinician than he was. This is a board-certified psychiatrist saying the PA was a better clinician than he was. So you need to look at the individual PA and what their experience is, but a sort of a blanket, no PAs have this training, no PAs have these skills, patients are at risk.
Mr. Lehman, we need to cut this off and move on. And Ms. Abderholen, is there something new that needs to be said? Please.
Yes, Madam Chair. The only other thing I wanted to mention is that when we found the form that originally had been agreed to by the Board of Medical Practice about what that collaborative agreement looks like, it's a series of check boxes. And treating serious mental illnesses is not on the list, and prescribing antipsychotics is not on the list. And so those agreements don't really protect people with serious mental illnesses. Thank you.
Well, I don't know that there's anything that says that that's the form that people use and that's what the collaborative agreement has to look like. I'm not aware of that, but okay. We're going to move on. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And the one thing perhaps left with this is, Mr. Harney, did you want to say anything about the spreadsheet for this at this point?
Madam Chair, members, not necessarily. If members have questions, I'm happy to clarify. The top half of the spreadsheet articulates the expenditures and appropriations made in Article 9. The second half of the spreadsheet shows the corresponding fee revenue into the state government special revenue fund. Big picture net impact to that fund is $138,000 in fiscal years 24 and 25 and a savings of $29,000 in the Dales.
Okay, thank you. So any questions about that, members? Okay, so the bill as amended is laid over laid over, and we'll take it up again tomorrow. So, okay. So now we are going to do House File 4993, and that is just, I'm just going to stay here. It's my bill, but it's very, very simple. And so this is just the forecast adjustment for the human services forecast. And actually, I'm going to ask Mr. Harney to speak to this because this is above my pay grade.
Madam Chair, House File 4993 simply makes adjustments to appropriations to the Commissioner of Human Services for fiscal years 24 and 25 for forecasted programs administered by the department. This conforms those appropriations made in Chapter 61 and Chapter 70 last year with the 2024 February forecast.
Okay. Questions about that? And just so members know, this is something that we usually do, put it in our omnibus bill. We always do this. It's basically, as I understand this, I'm sorry, I never moved the bill. I guess I need to move the bill. So I'm going to move House File 994-993 to move to Ways and Means, right? That's where we're going, to Ways and Means, because we're going to move. So what we're doing this year that's unusual is moving this separately, just to make sure that we do it, because we kind of have to do this. It's it basically, because we have forecasted programs, And we don't exactly know what they're going to be until time has gone by and we see how they've rolled out and how much money is being spent. Then we have to conform our, because we have to appropriate that money. So this appropriates the money to match the forecast. Mr. Harney,
yeah,
is that accurate?
Madam Chair, yeah, that's completely accurate. I would just speak plainly and say this does not create any new spending that isn't already accounted for in the February forecast.
Okay, so it's I would sort of characterize it as technical, but it's important. It has to happen. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just clarify that obviously significant increase to general fund spending, although I appreciate the clarification about forecast. Lines 2.3, there's a decrease coming out of the TANF fund. Is this exclusively based on actual cost versus forecasted costs, or are there any changes that are being made deliberately about where money is coming from or going to?
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, this is showing the change in expected spending in versus the November 23 forecast. So it's just a change in what the department assumes will happen occur in fiscal years 24 and 25.
Thank you.
Representative Nadeau.
Representative New Brindley asked most of my question, but one thing that confused me, Mr. Harney, was you said it doesn't have any impact on the forecast. So if this is making a change from the November forecast, can you just walk me through how it doesn't change the forecast?
Mr. Harney.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, fair characterization is that this doesn't add new spending from the February forecast. This merely aligns appropriations with the expected spending articulated in the February 24 forecast.
Representative Nadeau?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Okay. So with that, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm noticing that I'm looking under medical assistance, and that's a pretty big number, and wondering if anybody could tell us what's accounting for that. I suspect that I know. My hypothesis would be that it's coming from the federal guidance that you can't take anybody off the Medicaid rolls until you've fully unwound the great unwind.
Mr. Harney?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I'm certainly able to get back to you with the details on what's driving the increase in medical assistance costs. Just as a way of background, this is broken out into four different subcodes based on acute care, long-term care needs that split between this committee and Representative Norris' committee as it relates to jurisdiction. So while the details I'll provide to the committee later are certainly in this bill, they may ultimately reside in the Human Services Finance jurisdiction.
Thank you. And I do need to ask if anyone wants to testify on the bill. I'm not seeing any takers on that. So, okay. So with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 4993 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So all in favor, please say aye.
No.
Oh. Representative Brindley, we're in the middle of a vote.
Can I just get clarification? It's going to Ways and Means, but this might be out of the Human Services budget as well. It might not just be from the health budget.
It reflects both because it's intertwined, but it's not taking anything new out of anybody's budget. I mean, Mr. Harney?
Yeah, Madam Chair, that's correct. It's not. I think it's fair forecasted. To say it's not taking anything new out of the budget. The House has decided to split up the medical assistance jurisdiction into committees, but ultimately it's appropriated as one total appropriation for medical assistance, and that occurs in this committee's jurisdiction.
All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Okay. The next bill on the agenda is Representative Hennigsen-Yeager, House File 4391. And Representative Hennigsen-Yeager's motion is that House File 4391 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. So this bill, House File 4391, makes changes to the medical assistance, behavioral health, home benefit, and housing supports programs. It also removes obsolete provisions in the general assistance statutes. It has been vetted with community partners. And basically, it's intended to ensure that people are at the center of mental health program processes and that housing support provider processes are simplified and unambiguous. And I have Ms. Christy Grom here to go through any of the technical questions and details.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Grom, did you want to tell us what's in it more specifically?
Sure, Madam Chair. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services. This is one of our DHS policy bills. Want to thank you so much for hearing the bill. Thank Representative Hemmingson-Yeager for carrying it. And I'll just do a really quick walkthrough of the sections for members and happy to stand for questions. So sections 1 and 2 are related to the behavioral health home. So this is a medical assistance benefit that provides care coordination for people with serious mental illness, both adults and children. It's an integrated benefit, so it covers mental health, substance use disorder, physical health. And it's a really critical service for people in particular who have some pretty chronic health conditions. So a couple of changes we're making to this benefit that we heard from the community would be helpful. One of them is to remove the requirement that a provider obtain written consent. There's a particular form, the Behavioral Health Home Services Rights Responsibility and Consent Form, and that's the form that explains what the service is to people, gets their consent to make sure that that the provider can look at their diagnostic assessment to determine if they're eligible, and then gets their consent ultimately to be able to receive services if they're determined eligible. We had a variance or a flexibility during the pandemic that people could consent to this service electronically or by phone. That ended with the end of the public health emergency. We have most providers now are requesting a variance for this, and it's really an opportunity for providers to meet people where they're at and not make people jump through hoops. So we're making that change, and then also streamlining some of the provider requirements. So there's a requirement that providers use a specific tool, the partner portal tool, to help with care coordination and identify kind of current and past treatment, so that providers can understand what's happening with that individual across different care providers. And so we would be changing this to allow some more flexibility that providers could choose a tool as determined by DHS. We do have a tool, the Encounter Alert Service, that's working pretty well, that we think most providers will choose. Section 3 is just changing an effective date that was an error. It's just aligning it with a spreadsheet agreement from last session. It's related to a general assistance increase. There are two parts of that, of the general assistance statute, for a couple of different populations, and we missed one of the effective dates. So that increase is effective this October, and we're changing the effective date in that provision from October of 2023 to 2024 to align with the spreadsheet. Section 4 is related to the housing supports program. So this is just aligning requirements for providers with their housing support agreements that they have with counties, making sure that they're providing the minimum requirements. So things like laundry services, sheets, cleaning, things like that. Sections 5 and 6 are related to housing support as well. So this is housing support is reimbursed through two different methods. One way is that a provider might receive a payment for an individual person who is using that service, or the county might receive a lump sum payment, which covers sort of a range of time and expenditures over a period of time. That option is usually used for programs that have more transient populations, like emergency shelters. So not making any changes to how much they get paid here. We're just making sort of a mini recodification where we've got budget neutral transfers in two places in statute. We're consolidating them and making them clear so that providers understand what those expectations are, and so that we as an agency can implement appropriately. Section 7 is just renumbering some general assistance statutes related to a repealer, which is in Section 8. So this is repealing a now obsolete program called the Poor Relief Program. This was a program that prior to the safety nets that we have now, prior to the passage of the Social Security Act, the way people who were living in poverty, the way people who had mental illness, disabilities were served was that counties would essentially have pay people to live on a farm. It was sort of a form of indentured servitude. So That program has been abolished now as of 1973, I believe. It's no longer something that we do. Of course, we have general assistance and many other important safety net programs, and we're just repealing those provisions from the general assistance statute. They do live enshrined for people to see in a different area of statute for historical purposes. And that's the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there anyone who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick questions. One on the effective date change from October or from 23 to 24. Can I assume then that none of those payments went out? It won't require any sort of clawback or anything? It's just to align with what you believed was happening initially?
Ms. Grom?
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, that's correct.
Okay, great. Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only concern with this at all is on line 2.16, I'm concerned about completely eliminating written consent. And it seems like I'm concerned about the potential liability with just oral consent. If it can exclusively be by phone, I'm concerned that we don't have something in writing, some paper trail providing consent. Because since consent is required, if someone says, well, I didn't give my consent, what do we have? What do we have to deal with that issue? So certainly I would be very supportive of offering more options like electronic consent. It doesn't need to be complicated. But I am concerned that we are eliminating any need for a paper trail. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Brown?
Madam Chair, Representative, so this is really just the consent to begin services. Once services are commenced, there will be documents in writing that an individual will sign off on. There's a diagnostic assessment. There's an individual goes through the complete medical assistance eligibility process. So this is really just initiating that service so that people can get started right away and not be and get well, be connected to services.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Grom. Does this initial consent allow the department to begin requesting data on behalf of someone or information on behalf of someone?
Ms. Grom?
Madam Chair, Representative, not that I'm aware of. I know that the initial consent allows the individual provider to be able to look at the diagnostic assessment to confirm that the person is eligible for this service. So to be eligible, you have to have a serious mental illness as defined in federal law. So it's really that allowance for the provider to begin making sure that the individual is Medicaid eligible, that they've got the right diagnosis, they're eligible for the program, and that they do wish to, if they are eligible, that they want to begin services.
So Ms. Grom, does it get recorded anywhere? To Representative Brindley's point, I mean, is it go into a medical record?
Yeah.
Is there a record kept of it, of the consent?
Madam Chair, yes, it's my understanding that this would go into the individual's record, that the provider would document that consent.
Representative Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to make sure I understand. It would be the provider seeking the consent, and so the provider then would already have access to their diagnosis. I mean, presumably they were involved in diagnosis and that kind of issue, and this would give consent for the provider to look to verify that their diagnoses would qualify for them for these programs?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's part of it. It may not be that particular provider who made the diagnosis. I believe there's a 12-month period look back where an individual may have been diagnosed at one clinic and perhaps they moved or they're seeking a different provider that provides behavioral health home. So that provider would be able to go and get their consent to make sure that they've got the appropriate diagnosis to access the service and to initiate the service.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do appreciate the clarification. And with the clarification, my concern still stands then, because it's not just that provider verifying that they qualify for these programs. It's that they are looking at other data that exists And so we should probably have a more firm paper trail on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Madam Representative.
Chair, may I?
Oh, sure. Sorry, yeah. Representative Nixon-Yeager.
I just want to point out, too, that this kind of undergoes the behavioral health home services provider must, and then it just says obtain their consent. So should a provider choose a written, they could choose a written. Should they choose electronic, they could do that. This is just kind of, it just says some form of consent. And I know in lab best practices, we document everything, like every phone call I had, I took notes. So I would think that it is similar in the healthcare field.
Yeah, Ms. Grom, did you want to say something more?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, that is accurate. There needs to be documentation of a person's consent. If there weren't documentation, and there were to be some issue in the future, we would need to be able to understand that so we could potentially take back funds if there was some kind of issue.
Okay, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative New Brindley, the consent component is recorded in the documents. The provider will write down the date, the time. It's in there because that's part of the auditing process. In at least the contracts that I work in, when that consent is required and it has to be provided, they have to show how they did it. And many of them do it in writing. But I wanted to, and I had some questions around that too, and I think most of them were answered, because as things go on, there's a lot of written, I mean, for treatment plans, for diagnostic assessments, for data practices and data policies, all those are still remaining to be, they have to be signed off by clients or their guardian in this situation. This is not changing any of those. And then my other question with this one, with the ongoing treatment, can that also be consented to, or did I see the ongoing someplace else? To begin. I must have just made that up. My apologies. I wrote it down. So obtain the individual's written consent to begin receiving treatment. We're striking written, but for ongoing, for changes in need, when new evaluations get done, those written consents are still required, correct?
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, that's my understanding. Nothing about this bill changes any requirements around ongoing documentation.
Okay. And thank you, Madam Chair. And I have I have one more. In section six, I'm not super familiar with these transfers for Housing Support Fund, but can you just give me? I'm curious. These cost neutral transfers, are they based on reimbursements of payments, or are these appropriations or money that gets spent up front providing capacity, or is it reimbursement?
Ms. Grom.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, my understanding is it's generally an upfront payment based on estimated expenditures that a provider, that a county and their emergency shelters might have over a period of time. And all of that is, housing support is a forecasted program. And so all of that is kind of worked out between at DHS, our reports and forecast, and the county who's engaging in an agreement on those particular transfers.
Okay, and that's what I saw. Those. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. All right, not seeing any other members on the list. So that being the case, any final word, Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager?
No, I appreciate a good cleanup bill and would appreciate your support.
Okay. All right. With that, House File 4391 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And finally, we have Representative Fisher. And Representative Fisher is going to move that House File 4393 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an A2 amendment to put the bill in the proper form for discussion. And why don't we just, is that your amendment, Representative Fisher?
Yes, Chair Liebling, that is my amendment. Basically what it does is it removes a couple of provisions that belong over in the child care area, children and families, so it's removing that and it's being heard. These are provisions that need to be heard actually in another committee. They're not in our jurisdiction.
Okay, very good. We're always happy to have less to have to deal with.
Yes.
Over here. Okay. So let's adopt the A2 then. So Representative Fisher is moving the A2 amendment to House Bill 4393. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, committee, for the opportunity to present House File 4393. I will first of all say this is a bill that is still being worked on. There are some concerns that came up at the last committee that are still being worked on back and forth between March and another group. This is one of the things that we are still following up with. So I appreciate the fact that we're laying it over so we can continue the work. Basically, this is a bill the Department of Human Services Office of Inspector General has put out. It's their policy bill. It does a number of things. There's technical fixes and policy changes to licensing requirements and processes. It includes modifying the process of changing ownership of license programs, so it is an example. And it also takes a look at issues around compliance issues. So if you've got a program right now that is appealing a decision whether they should continue on or not, it sets some guidelines out that make it very clear that the department is able to put on additional guide rails to make sure that the program is continuing under appeal, that there can be some additional guardrails to make sure that things are running well and people are being saved. So those are some things that are also happening in it. It also has modifiers, provisions to the background study procedures. It allows for some temporary waivers or modifications to behavioral study requirements. Adds some disqualifying crimes and conduct and modifies withdrawal management, substance use disorder treatment, and opioid treatment licensing provisions. It also addresses making sure, helping address the issue around programs, making sure they have emergency access to medications when people have overdoses, et cetera. Helps clarifying some of the rules in there. I do have a person here from the department that can also go into it a little bit further.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Fisher. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ari Didion. I am the acting legislative director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. Like Representative Fisher said, this bill is a policy bill from the Office of Inspector General and contains changes related to DHS licensing, background studies, and program integrity. And I will just kind of very quickly go through them. Chair Fisher did a great job of explaining his bill. This contains several policy proposals, one of which is a clarifying change around a change in ownership when a licensed facility is changing hands. That's a previously passed change, and the changes in this bill just provide clarification about that change. There's also a proposal contained in this bill that allows licensing to put in conditions when a license has been revoked. License holders have the ability to appeal a revocation, and this change just allows licensing to put in place conditions for that provider to operate under while they are appealing a revocation. There's also a proposal that would make the email addresses for licensed programs public information. This is largely in order to be able to respond to requests from other state agencies and other parts of DHS for these business email addresses. There's also a proposal related to key staff position changes in certain licensed programs. This relates to important positions like the medical director, program director, and registered nurses. And programs are required to keep folks in these roles. And so what this change does is just require providers to notify DHS licensing within 5 days of a change, because we had seen some programs operating without someone in these key roles for a number of months. I will say that we've received feedback from March as well as MARTAP, the both provider associations in the substance use disorder treatment space around this proposal, and are happy to keep working with them on clarifying this and making sure that this makes sense for our providers. There's also a proposal related to off-site substance use disorder treatment. And so this just provides clarification in statute about when services can be provided outside of the license holder's primary location and provides clarification around providing telehealth. And then there's also a series of technical changes related to licensing. These are primarily kind of cleanup and fixes related to changes the past and previous sessions. There's also a proposal from our background studies division that creates an emergency option for name and date of birth only background studies in an emergency. This is something that background studies did during the COVID-19 pandemic when fingerprint locations were closed. And so this just formally creates that option were another situation like that to arise and people would be unable to meet the fingerprinting requirement. There's also a set of changes to the background studies statute relating to aligning with current practice and other areas of statute, as well as conforming with changes to the criminal code. There's a set of background studies changes to Chapter 245C that align Chapter 245C and background studies requirements based on federal requirements and just kind of aligns the requirements for several similar background study types. And then finally, there is a clarifying change related to a previously passed change for certain mailings using a signature confirmed delivery service. There was a previously passed change that required the use of certified mail, and this just kind of opens that up for other signature confirmed delivery methods. And I'd like to thank Chair Fischer for carrying our policy bill, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
All right, thank you very much for that. Representative Nadel. Oh, wait, before we do that. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry, because we do have a testifier and I need to. So come on down, Mr. Bergeron, and then if anyone else in the room wants to testify on the bill, we'll open it up for testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Matthew Bergeron, the law firm of Larkin Hoffman. Here today, this morning, on behalf of the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Programs, there are two elements of this bill that we just wanted to raise a couple of concerns about, but I will note both comments from the department and Representative Fischer. We're having really good ongoing conversations in this space, so I don't want to overstate where we are in the process, but just flag two things. The first is relating to the notice of a change or vacancy in the key positions. Maritap fully understands the idea that the frequency of licensing reviews may result in a program potentially providing non-compliant services as a result of a vacancy for a long period of time and the department's desire to try to find an earlier touch point. However, I think if a program is going to practice without a treatment director or a medical director, they're probably not going to fill out the paperwork sending in to the department to tell them their intent to do so. And instead, the requirement that you submit something within 5 days just means that compliant programs are going to have this additional paperwork requirement. And we don't necessarily know that it actually gets at the policy goal of finding that like little red flag to go, hey, we need to go look at this program because they may have an issue there. And so we're talking with the department about some alternatives there that might shift how that would work in such a way that it would be more meaningful and impactful for the department to actually find out a program that might be having the kind of a compliance staffing issues there. The second issue is one relating to the delivery of telehealth. And you'll notice on page 44 of the bill and 44.12 language, it says the license holder must not provide treatment services remotely by telehealth to a group of clients meeting together in person. The idea being that the clinician is in one place and you've got a room maybe doing an SUD group session, everybody's together in another place. While Maritap definitely agrees that that's probably not a regular or best practice for that kind of clinical intervention, in rural communities with small providers and with workforce shortages and things like communicable disease quarantines and weather events, a blanket prohibition on the use of that, particularly when sometimes that session may be what is necessary for a residential program to qualify for its per diem, And if you've got a clinician who maybe needs to stay at home but is still able to provide that service, it would be able to come in into that instance. We think it, particularly for smaller rural programs where they may only have one LADC who provides their sessions or two LADCs, that a blanket prohibition is probably going too far, as far as moving away from maybe what isn't a preferred delivery model towards, you know, while still having some flexibility, recognizing the situations in these provider communities. So that's the other place where we're working with the department to recognize how and when that might potentially be an appropriate service delivery mechanism, you know, particularly as it accounts for rural providers. So thank you so much for the time to share those thoughts with you today, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Fisher and the department.
Thank you. Thanks for the testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So we will go to the discussion then of Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Fisher. Excuse me. My question is really limited, and it's on lines 13.10 to 13.20. It has to do with 245D providers. And it's kind of talking about satellite licenses, and I thank you for the work, whoever started doing this. But my question is it going far enough for those providers? As we're moving, those providers are moving really, really, really rapidly to this person-centered care, away from center-based. You know, it's really community-integrated populations. And I know that we've had problems with co-licensing common space from DHS. So, for example, provider A has a big facility. It's not really used that much anymore because they've moved away from center base. And provider B has clients up around provider A's location, and they've got space, and they want to use that for meeting or for doing some types of day services. And currently, DHS has not been able to co-locate a license for that space. I would argue once it's licensed, it's irrelevant. There shouldn't be a problem. But we've got providers trying to work together, and they're not able to because facility licensure has inhibited them from having clients that aren't being served by the provider in a facility that's not under their licensure. Can you talk? I know that's super weedy. I'm sorry, but can you talk? That is a real issue that's happening today. Can you talk to that a little bit?
So, Chair Fisher, I don't know if you want Ms. Didion to do that.
I would prefer Ms. Didion. This is way down into the weeds.
Okay, Ms. Didion.
Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, can you clarify? I'm just wondering what the question was, or were you just looking for more information around these 245D and satellite locations?
Representative Nadeau.
Will this language permit two providers with two licensed facilities to commingle their populations without each of them having to have a license for the other's common space? For example, does a provider need to, if they're gonna have work with a school in a cafeteria for 4 hours? Would this allow them to create a satellite license in that school to provide services to 245D people?
Madam Chair, I'm going to have our licensing director speak to that one.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you would just state your name for the record, please, and go ahead and try to answer that question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Alyssa Dotson, and I am the Deputy Inspector General for the Licensing Division in the Office of Inspector General. Thank you for the question. This specific provision here is not expanding the use of different types of satellite licenses. This here is about when there's a change of ownership. So these satellite licenses that we're talking about under 245D are the community residential settings, which are typically referred to as like group homes, where there's four persons living in a home in a single residential home there. So that's what those community residential settings are. So this temporary kind of transitional license is specific to our change of ownership proposal, where we have seen right now what happens when you have a 245D provider who is kind of that main license holder who may have, you know, up to 10, 20, you know, 30 different licenses under them. When there's a change of ownership, that residential license, that community residential license there, has additional licensing, kind of that settings license that it has to go through. And so we don't want to interrupt care to the individuals who are living in that home while we are going through that change of ownership process. So this allows us to then give them a temporary transitional license because they've already been licensed, they are currently living there, while we're working through that change of ownership so that we're not interrupting their care or services while we're transitioning to a new owner there. It's not creating a new type of satellite license necessarily for individuals.
Representative Doe, does that help?
Well, kind of. I was more hopeful before you sat down. It's the 245D, I mean, 27, these are day services. And so if I were a provider, I would look at this and say, you know what, this should be hopeful for me. You know, it's gonna kind of give me another avenue to try to serve more people by partnering with another licensed facility or making it a satellite license easier to get. But what you're saying is that's not the case, even though it's talking about day service providers specifically.
Was it Dodson?
Dodson, yes, thank you. Yes, thank you. Sorry, it is for those residential services, and sorry, I misspoke. That it is for the day services facilities as well. Again, under that main 245D kind of parent license, we call it, programs can have day services facilities. So again, it's just specific to that change of ownership around that as well, again, to make sure that we're not interrupting services for clients who are currently receiving services while they're going through that change of ownership process.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to talk to Representative Fisher about this offline a little bit more. Maybe I can hopefully expand it just a little.
Well, that'd be great. And thanks for your attention to this. And, you know, as he said, it's a little bit of a work in progress. And hopefully we'll get all these things worked out before we finish the omnibus bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Fisher. I first just want to say I really appreciate, as I reviewed the language, it seems like there are a lot of provisions strengthening protections, particularly for children. And I really appreciate that. Question on sections, let's see here, sections 15 and 16, and this is regarding in-home daycare centers with the requirements for the attached garage and the wall between a garage and a home, and then stairways. Are these requirements currently in state building code, or will this be above and beyond what is current state building code?
And just recall, Representative New Brindley, we took out Section 16 with the amendment.
I apologize.
So I think 15 is still there, though,
15
right?
15 is still there.
So Representative Fisher.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
And I'll defer to my testifier here.
Okay.
Who's the expert?
Ms. Dodson.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the question, member. These are just conforming to current state fire code. These are not above and beyond any requirements beyond that. These are just conforming changes to the current code.
Representative New Brindley.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that. That makes sense. And that is not then sort of an onerous requirement for folks. My other question is on page 27. And I apologize. Somehow I missed the amendment when I was reviewing the bill. Normally I note these things on my copy. But it doesn't look like this section is affected. On the disqualification from direct contact. I apologize. That's not the section that I wanted. It's page 37, I think. On the risk of harm set aside, the end at the bottom of page 37, it adds paragraph C for an individual seeking child foster care. I just want to ensure sort of the order of operations here. when we're looking at, and maybe there's a question for nonpartisan staff, I'm not sure, but when we're considering the sort of the order of operations, would paragraph B be considered priority over paragraph C? Does that question make sense? I mean, because we've got some things that really need to be considered when it comes to a risk of harm set aside. But then in paragraph C, we add a new provision that says, but we also, you know, want to consider a familial relationship. And I just want to make sure that we still prioritize paragraph B, if that makes sense.
So is that Ms. Sunderman?
Madam Chair and members, they're not listed in priority order. They can be read together, paragraphs B and C. So paragraph C is in addition to paragraph B. Just the lettering doesn't indicate any prioritization. Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Sunderland. Perhaps Representative Fisher, and I don't know what your intention here is. I mean, I think obviously the intention is good, particularly with child foster care. But I'm wondering if we could ensure in the language that there sort of is an order of operations that even before we're considering that familial relationship, we're considering things like the vulnerability of the person being served, the harm suffered by the victim, time elapsed. It seems like those considerations are really important, and I would hate to prioritize a familial relationship in situations where it might not be appropriate there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any comment, Representative Fisher, on that?
Thank you for the suggestion. We'll go back to the department, talk to the folks in the department, and see if that makes sense. And also, if there's others who have feedback as to does that cause any other complications in doing this type of work? Because sometimes I know that when we've put priorities and we've had the unintended consequences, and all of a sudden somebody gets locked out, and kind of all of a sudden they can't provide services, and it was kind of like it was their son or daughter type. So I just want to make sure we're keeping an eye out for that.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion? We have like 2 minutes. Okay, not seeing any. So Representative Fisher, any final word?
No, thank you for the input. I appreciate it. This is one that we will continue working on. I know that we've got a number of emails that are going back and forth, and we will definitely take the input that we've got here today and continue those discussions.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Fisher. So with that, House File 4393, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And thank you very much for the good discussion today. We are coming back tomorrow for markup in our regular time, and we have some other bills on the agenda as well. So see you all tomorrow. We stand adjourned.